Hello, all you wonderfully strange and unusual creatures.
I'm Corey.
And I'm Courtney. And this is Sinister Crimes and Cocktails, a true crime show that digs into the dark depths of sinister minds, their menacing crimes, and mistakes left behind, all while sipping on a sinister cocktail masterminded by Corey for each episode.
We want to first start out by saying that our sinister cocktails featured for each episode is just to help us lighten the mood a bit on the dark and horrific crimes we cover. And in no way, shape, or form are we trying to make light of the horrific crimes. Please know our hearts go out to the victims, their families and friends, and law enforcement affected by each of the cases we cover.
Okay, Corey, what sinister cocktail have you masterminded for today's episode?
I'm calling this one Sinister Sam. 1.5 ounces of rum chata, 1/2 ounce of whipped vodka, 4 ounces of Cinnamon Toast Crunch cereal milk. Combine all these ingredients into a shaker and shake with some ice. Give it a good shake. Double strain into a glass with a ice in it. Garnish with some whipped cream and some Cinnamon Toast Crunch cereal. And enjoy.
It's so good. This might be one of my favorites.
Oh, it's absolutely my favorite. I mean, hands down, it tastes like you're eating a bowl of Cinnamon Toast Crunch.
It's so good. It really does taste like
it. If you don't like cinnamon, you're in trouble. But if you do, you're going to love this.
It's really good. Your dad would not like it.
No, my dad would totally be like, get that shit away from me.
So, all you wonderfully strange and unusual creatures, pour yourself a cocktail and settle in for this sinister true crime. Are serial killers born or made? Believe us, you're gonna need it. From July of 1976 to July of 1977, one of America's most notorious serial killers, David Berkowitz, better known by his moniker, the Son of Sam, swept panic through the streets and boroughs of New York City with a murder spree that captivated the nation and ignited a media frenzy. Over the course of that year, in 3 of the city's boroughs, Berkowitz, using a .44 caliber bulldog revolver, randomly shot New York citizens, leaving 6 dead and 7 wounded. He left handwritten letters at some of the crime scenes in which he taunted and insulted the police for their fruitless efforts to capture him and expressed his determination to continue his work. Berkowitz's deadly shooting rampage spawned one of the biggest manhunts in New York City's history, ending in August of 1977 with the capture of the 24-year-old, finally putting to rest New York City's notorious summer of fear. Berkowitz confessed to the string of brutal attacks, claiming that he had received orders to kill from his neighbor, Sam Carr, which had been communicated through Sam's black Labrador retriever that had become possessed by a 6,000-year-old demon. Despite Berkowitz's story of devils, demons, and passion, numerous psychological evaluations declared him competent to stand trial. So, was the Son of Sam just a sinister mind who had a lust for killing, or was he suffering from severe mental health issues that had been the catalyst into creating a serial killer?
So, the Son of Sam case definitely has all kinds of wrapped up funness in it for serial killers, because you really have somebody who, to me, when you ask if they were born or made, this guy's, he's born with, you know, not all the cylinders firing off correctly in his brain, is the best way to say it. And we'll get into a little bit how competency works, because a lot of people are like, he should have been competent. He should have been found incompetent because of, you know, his state of mind. And we'll get into it a little bit later, but competence and saneness and, you know, mentally ill, you can be competent and still be mentally ill when it comes to facing something you did wrong. So we'll get into that a little bit later. But yeah, this is going to be a fun case to talk about.
Agree.
I mean, come on, it's got everything you like. Demons. I mean, it's kind of wrapped up, you know, present here for serial killers.
David Richard Berkowitz was born Richard David Falco on June 1, 1953 in Brooklyn, New York, to unwed parents, Jewish American Elizabeth Broder and Italian American Tony Falco, who had split shortly before his birth. Elizabeth, coming from a meager background and working as a waitress, put her son up for adoption when he was just a few days old. Abandonment issues?
Absolutely. And no telling what's in their background and what's wrong with them and what goes back, you know, centuries of what's in their his genetics that causes this kind of rampage.
True. Berkowitz was quickly adopted by a Jewish middle-aged couple, Pearl and Nathan Berkowitz, who were childless. The Berkowitz changed their adoptive son's name, reversing his first and middle name, and he was given their surname. According to the Crime Wire, David Berkowitz grew up in a seemingly ordinary household in New York City's Bronx borough. His adoptive parents, who were hardware store realtors, raised David in a middle-class neighborhood, providing him with a relatively stable upbringing. So far, no red flags.
Yeah, like oftentimes you do see this with some serial killers where they were brought up with love, affection, attention, but something was always off. So when you say, like we said at the beginning of this, born or made, this is where the born comes in over the made.
I would agree. However, his early childhood years were not without challenges. David, reportedly a smart child, was troubled in his own way. He had only a few close friends, was said to have violent tendencies, and struggled with feelings of rejection, as well as identity issues.
So what are we already dealing with? Let's look at this mental health wise, right? He's definitely screaming antisocial personality.
Agreed.
Definitely, to me, he's more towards the psychopath over the sociopath tendencies, just because he is somebody who really has very little emotion in him when it comes to anything. So that's, to me, even his own self's need. He doesn't serve a need with these things. He's just doing it because it's what entertains him.
I would agree with that. Some psychologists believe these feelings of inadequacy stemmed from his adoption and that these internal conflicts contributed to his mental health decline.
I would agree.
I would agree too. While David was reported to have an above average intelligence, he lost interest in school quite early on and began engaging in criminal activities such as petty larceny and pyromania. It was reported that his adoptive parents consulted at least one psychotherapist due to his misconduct. However, his delinquent behavior never led to legal troubles or impacted his school record.
Yeah, and this is a great point here, too. So now you're looking at his above average intelligence. You see that a lot with serial killers, right? But you also see that a lot in antisocial personality people anyway. They're very highly intelligent. They don't really fit in. They're very big outcast of their social, you know, area, world, whatever you want to call it, class. And then the larceny and the pyromania, he's starting fires. He's, you know, doing petty thefts just because he likes to. For me, what really fed him a little bit is he liked the thrill of not getting caught. He liked the thrill of taunting people. And that's why thefts and pyromania is, hey, I did this. I get to watch my work, but I don't get caught. That was, I think, was the only thrill he really fed in his psyche.
I can definitely see that. Regardless of his juvenile antics, he had an extremely close relationship with his adoptive mother, Pearl. In 1967, when Berkowitz was 14, Pearl passed away from breast cancer, which he had a difficult time coping with and became more of a loner. His erratic behavior seemed to intensify when his adoptive father remarried in 1971 and moved to Florida without him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Damn. Talk about complete abandonment. I mean, he's definitely, I think his psychosis, his mental illness is driven by abandonment.
I would agree with that.
Because not only did he lose his biological parents, but then he loses his, what he deems to be his mother, right, to cancer. And then his father just ups and moves away from him and gets a whole new family. I mean, definitely abandonment issues here.
I fucking agree.
And one way to deal with that, to me, is the comparison to his means of killing. And we'll get into that in a minute. But I think it has a correlation with the abandonment issues he has.
I think you're right, Corey.
Ooh.
It was also reported that Berkowitz had an extreme dislike for his new stepmother. Well, I would imagine.
I know, right?
Like, I don't think I'd like her either.
Took my dad away.
No shit. That same year that his adoptive father left for Florida with his new wife, 18-year-old David Berkowitz joined the United States Army and served for 3 years in South Korea, where he excelled as a proficient marksman. In June of 1974, he was honorably discharged from the Army and returned to New York City, securing a job as a letter sorter for the U.S. Postal Service, where his co-workers described him as a loner who kept to himself.
But this is where he finds a love for letters, right? Think about that.
Yeah.
And then we're going to get into like the manner and means of his killings. But this is where he starts to find the love for letters and the ability he sees to communicate through the Postal Service.
I didn't think about that, but I think you're right, Corey.
I know. I told you. This is one of my favorite serial killers to cover. He's an interesting guy because he really is a total package kind of thing.
He is. Also, another serial killer who was in the military in mm-hmm. some sort of capacity.
Sure.
You see that a lot.
And trained him.
Yes.
Trained him to be a marksman.
And he did well in it. And you see that a lot, that mm-hmm. a lot of serial killers do well in the military.
Yeah, it's almost odd that they, because a lot of serial killers have that, what they now call, in my opinion, back then they would have had opposition defiance disorder where they don't like authority. And a lot of serial killers, I can see where authority, especially with him, they don't like authority. They like to challenge authority. So for me, this is what's really, really interesting in this case, because when you go into the military, it's all authority, right? It's authority driven kind of life. So I almost wonder if it doesn't help them just kind of relieve themselves a little bit and just follow orders and get to hide and get to be sinister and hide within a group. The things they like to do, shoot guns, kill people, that kind of stuff doesn't really get taken up like, oh, you're a bad guy. Oh, no, actually, you're awesome. Here's a reward for you being able to shoot somebody at point blank range. Great job. Here you go. Military and serial killing really does make me wonder, but I think it's just the lifestyle that it provides for them that they like for it, in my opinion.
I can see that. Shortly after settling in New York City, David Berkowitz located his birth mother, Elizabeth, who revealed the details of his birth, which seemed to greatly disturb him, and eventually their relationship lapsed. Forensic anthropologist Elliot Layton described David's discovery of his birth details as the primary crisis of his life, a revelation that shattered his sense of identity.
Sure.
You think it's because his parents were unwed and that's...
I think it was more that he already had such a deep abandonment issue at this point when he reconnects with his birth mother. And then to hear that he wasn't really wanted, I think it's just he had such severe abandonment issues that getting to know his mom and her saying, I just gave you up because I didn't want you, just put that nail in the coffin for me. And that's why I think this psychologist or the anthropologist, I think that's why he said that it was the primary crisis in his life, because it's what flipped the switch. What have I told you about serial killers, right? They flip a switch. They walk that line and all of a sudden, bloop.
There's something that turns them.
Something that turns them. And for this is the one thing that got him, because I think it really pushed that abandonment issue and that imbalance in his brain to the point where serial killing now was his primary goal. And for me, they put him under a serial killer. I look at Berkowitz more as a mass killer. He wanted to kill as many people as he could because he liked fucking with the cops. He liked challenging his authority. He liked being not caught. That's what he was doing. So he had to kill so he could keep writing the letters. He could keep his communication. He could keep feeding that deep need of attention that he really, really sought. That's what he wanted. The attention of, because we're getting really deep into it. We're only a little bit into the podcast and I feel bad. But for me, Berkowitz, he had a deep need of needing to be accepted. And I think in the army, it gave him a little bit of that acceptance because he was accepted, because everything he liked to do was accepted in that lifestyle. You know, the shooting, the being a soldier, the killing, all that kind of stuff was all accepted. It wasn't looking bad upon him. So he liked it. And I would love to have seen maybe stuff that happened over in Korea during this time that they just offset, didn't care, never made it over to the States to the news, to see if he didn't start over there with whatever was going on.
I would agree with that.
Just saying. But I think that's one thing that leads him to being a mass killer. A serial killer, yes, that's what they classify him as. I'm not gonna go against classifications on this, but to me, he leans more towards a mass killer just because he liked it. I mean, he didn't kill for sexual reasons. He didn't kill for, you know, anything like that. He killed more for just, he liked the attention of it.
I would agree with that. After learning about the details of his birth, David Berkowitz began to feel isolated from the world, causing a further decline in his mental health. In his diary, he wrote that he had set around 1,500 fires in New York City in the mid-1970s without ever being caught. Do you think that's true?
Probably. I absolutely think that's true. Because remember, that's what's feeding his need of attention, right? He does it, and then he gets to read in the paper, see on the news,
another fire
that caught him. And then all of a sudden, that's like, ooh, I like this. And the way he kills people, he doesn't... Remember what I've said before, our podcast about this court, about the personalization of killing, right? Stabbing somebody, strangling somebody. That's a very personal, close kind of thing. He shoots him with a gun from a distance. So he's not having to be up too close and personal with them, right? He's not having to interact with them in any way outside of just pointing the gun and shooting him. But then he gets to go back and read the news the next day and see, oh, look, I did that. Ha ha ha. That's me. I'm getting attention and feeding that need without being caught. That's why I said he's really interesting in this fact.
During this time, he purportedly also began to hear voices of demons that tormented him and told him to commit murder. Not good. According to Berkowitz, he committed his first attack attempting murder at the age of 22, claiming that on Christmas Eve in 1975, he had stabbed 15-year-old Michelle Foreman 6 times with a hunting knife on a bridge near Dreiser Loop, believing that he was driven by demons. Michelle's injuries were so severe that she had to be hospitalized for a week. At the time, Berkowitz was not looked at as a suspect. Now, using a knife to try to commit murder would not be a mistake that he would make again.
Sure, because it was probably too, like I just said, it was probably too close, too personal for him, right? Because that's not feeding his need, right?
Yeah.
So he needs something a little bit more drastic, something that's going to kill right away. A gun.
As reported by History.com, in January of 1976, Berkowitz began working as a security guard and moved into a two-family home in Yonkers, a borough of New York City. While living there, he became convinced that the German Shepherd that lived at the shared residence and the other neighborhood dogs were possessed by demons who ordered him to murder attractive young women. Buddy, you need some help.
Well, I bet his mom was attractive. His biological mom was attractive.
Oh, I bet she was too, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Not only was he hallucinating of dogs being possessed by demons, but he also began to see his neighbors as demons as well. It was reported that during this time, one of the neighborhood dogs was shot and later speculated that it was done by Berkowitz.
That makes sense.
Yep. Well, especially if the dogs are telling him to kill people, I'd fucking kill that dog too. I'd be like, not today. In April of 1976, Berkowitz moved to an apartment in another area of Yonkers, perhaps to move away from the demonic dogs that surrounded him. But unfortunately, his new residence was no stranger to dogs either. His neighbor, retiree Sam Carr, had a black Labrador retriever named Harvey, who Berkowitz believed was commanding him to kill. I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh.
No, it is funny because you're like, how, I think for our listeners too, it's hard to understand being in that type of mindset if you've never been in it. It's hard to be like, really? You're listening to a fucking dog to go kill people? Come on.
Like, was his mouth opening and closing and talking to you, or was it just mind communication?
I feel like it was Jedi stuff. It was mind communication. I don't feel like it. But, you know, Berkowitz is still alive. We could talk to him. Might be fun.
Corey, there you go. Reach out to him. Berkowitz also saw Sam Carr as a powerful demon and was referring to him when he called himself Son of Sam. What?
This poor old man living next door don't have no fucking idea.
Nope. He's just like, what?
He's like, I would take my dog out in the morning. That's all I do.
Now I got somebody naming themselves after me.
Being a serial killer, great.
On July 28, 1976, Berkowitz quit his job as a security guard, and the very next day, on July 29th, he began his killing rampage, starting in Pelham Bay area of the Bronx with two teenage girls. 18-year-old Judy Valenti and 18-year-old Donna Loria had been sitting in Judy's double-parked car in front of Donna's home when a man approached the car and fired three bullets from a .44 caliber Bulldog revolver and then quickly walked away. He didn't want to stay around.
No.
Or do you think he didn't want to see the aftermath either of what he'd done?
Again, like I said, yeah, I think that's probably why he picked the means of which way he killed. He wanted it to be quick, easy, done, walk away, and then go home to the news and wait for it to hit the news and go, ha, that was me, and feed that need of attention.
Donna was killed instantly, and Judy was shot in the thigh. Judy described their attacker as a white male in his 30s, approximately 5'8" and about 200 pounds, with short, dark, curly hair. A few months later, on the early morning of October 24, 1976, Berkowitz struck again, this time in the Queensboro residential area of Flushing. Spotting 20-year-old Carl De Niro, who was walking with 18-year-old Rosemary Keenan, in yet another parked car, fired his .44 caliber Bulldog revolver at them and then once again walked away. Both survived, but Carl was hit in the head by one of the bullets, resulting in a massive injury to his skull. Police would later speculate Carl may have been mistaken for a woman due to his shoulder-length hair. Yeah. Do you think that was true?
I think that's absolutely true. Because, again, he's not going to get too close. He just needs to kill and go. And he likes to kill women because, of course, I think it's correlated to his
abandonment.
His abandonment with his birth mother. Sorry, I couldn't get that out. But I think it has correlation to his birth mother's abandonment and that story. I think that's why he went after the women. And I bet she was pretty. And I bet that's why he went after young, pretty women.
A little more than a month later, on November 26, 16-year-old Donna DeMasi and 18-year-old Joanne Lamino were headed to Joanna's home in Floral Park, Queens after a late-night movie when they were approached on the street by a man dressed in military fatigues. The man then produced a .44 caliber Bulldog revolver and shot each woman once. Their assailant then fired several more times before running away. Donna was shot in the neck and survived without permanent injury. However, Joanne, who was shot in the back, was left paralyzed. That sucks.
Totally sucks.
At this time, police had not yet put together that these shootings, which had no motives behind them, were all connected and instead suspected that it was several different culprits. But to be fair, so far, few bullets were found intact at the crime scenes. Do you think he was picking up the shell casings?
Well, and you have to remember, he's using a revolver. So shell casings don't come out in the revolvers.
Oh, that's true. They stay in.
So it's the kind of gun that he's using is what happened. So he was able to take that home with him. So the only thing that would be left behind would be the bullets within the victims.
Okay. In just a few short months, that would all change. On January 30th, 1977, once again in the Flushing area of Queens, Berkowitz approached another parked car where 26-year-old Christine Frewind and her fiancé, 30-year-old John Dial, were sitting and talking. Berkowitz shot his .44-caliber Bulldog revolver twice into the car, striking Christine in the head. John, panicking, sped away from the scene to a local hospital. He suffered only minor injuries, but Christine later died from her head wound in the hospital.
Wow.
That's so sad.
That is sad. And I'm sure he was probably conceived in the back of a car somewhere, so that's probably why he's picking cars with people in it. I mean, that's what I would think.
I could totally see that.
Like, I can see his mom being like, you were a mistake. You were a backseat, one-night stand, and you turned out, so we got rid of you.
And
that would fuck a kid up.
Yeah, it would. And all of these seem so random. It's not like it doesn't seem like he's stalking his prey. Seems like he's going out and he's like, yep, there we go.
It's just like the mass shooters you see now. They just walk in and start shooting. There's no rhyme or reason to their victim. They just start shooting and kill as many as they can.
Yeah. On March 8th, 1977, as 19-year-old college student Virginia Vosker Cayenne was walking home from her evening classes in the same neighborhood where Christine and her fiancé had been attacked, she was shot in the head and killed instantly. This time, however, a bullet was found intact at the crime scene, and it matched a bullet found at the scene of Berkowitz's first murder.
Now they've got their corroborating evidence.
Yep.
Now they know they're looking for the same person.
Like the previous shootings, there appeared to be no motive, but because Berkowitz used the same .44-caliber gun in all his escapades, the police now began suspecting that all the shootings were related.
Yay, police!
Yay! With the local newspapers reporting on the shootings daily, the police had no other choice but to address the crimes publicly, announcing that they believed that they had a serial killer on the loose, known to be a white male in his 20s with black hair and an average height and build.
Wow.
I'm guessing the black hair, average height and build is maybe from other witnesses on the street.
Maybe.
That might have seen it. I mean, I don't know. Or you think they found hair? This is the 70s, so I mean.
Yeah, I think this is really kind of hard to speculate on that. I mean, who knows? I mean, honestly, I mean, I think more of the eyewitness stuff from the people who lived is more of where they're getting their clues from than anything else.
Okay. The New York Police Department stated that all the shootings bore similarities, such as all the victims were struck with the same .44-caliber bullets, and the assailant appeared to be attacking young women with long, dark hair.
And that's when the Karen haircut became famous in the
70s. Yep. And everybody was cutting their hair off. The police initially referred to the serial killer as the .44-caliber killer, and a large group of detectives was organized called the Omega Task Force to hunt the serial killer down. Public anxiety was only heightened as the media frenzy of a serial killer on the loose engulfed the nation. New York City's streets and boroughs became paralyzed with fear. As public concern grew to panic proportions, women began getting rid of their long brown hair, believing it was preferred by the serial shooter, along with residences fearing to venture out after dark, causing nightclubs and restaurants to see a dramatic drop in business, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. I mean, total panic.
The heightened fear also spurred a massive increase in gun sales and prompted the introduction of new legislation to regulate firearms. That's kind of crazy that new legislation was brought in because of this time and fear.
And agreed on so quickly to get passed.
Yeah, you don't see that ever happening anymore, do you?
No, it takes forever now, yeah.
All you need is a good serial killer.
There you go.
Just 1 month after his last deadly shooting, Berkowitz set his sights on another couple in the Bronx. In the early morning hours of April 17, 1977, 18-year-old Valentina Serini and her 20-year-old boyfriend Alexander Esau were sitting in Valentina's car parked near the Hutchinson River Parkway when they were shot by the same .44-caliber revolver. Alexander died at the scene, while Valentina later passed away at the hospital. But this crime scene would differ. For the first time, the killer announced his identity via a handwritten note left near the victim's bodies. The letter, mostly written in black capitals with few lowercase letters, was addressed to the NYPD's Captain Joseph Borelli, calling himself Son of Sam for the first time and promised that the killings would continue. You know, those police were like, what the fuck?
Yep, and now you've got one taunting you.
Yep. Oh, you know they were pissed too.
Oh, you know it.
Those New Yorkers, I mean, they're
nothing unites like a common enemy.
Throughout the rest of his killing spree, Berkowitz left numerous letters near his victims' bodies, taunting the police and eluding their capture. As a result, the media coverage of his crimes became even further sensationalized, and Berkowitz began relishing himself in the spotlight, all while New Yorkers lived in fear of being his next victim. Per History.com, on April 29, 1977, Berkowitz's neighbor, Sam Carr, reported to the Yonkers police that his Labrador retriever, Harvey, had been shot by an unseen culprit. Shit's more escalated.
Yep, shit's getting real.
Thankfully, Harvey survived his wounds. Now, Sam Carr had previously been sent an anonymous threatening letter concerning his dog and believed Berkowitz was behind it. The Yonkers Police Department opened an investigation, with Berkowitz being their main suspect. Uh-oh, you shouldn't be doing this, buddy.
I know, right?
Not if you're killing.
Duh.
Berkowitz's mental health seemed to further decline when he began sending bizarre letters to other neighbors and his former landlords. These individuals began to suspect Berkowitz to be the son of Sam and reported their suspicions to the local police. The Omega Task Force was subsequently notified, but the detectives had received thousands of reports of the son of Sam's suspects and were having a difficult time sifting through all the leads.
Yeah.
This is why you don't call with bullshit leads, people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's exactly. And also, too, you have to understand how many people would have fit his description in New York in this time. A lot.
A lot.
It would have been difficult.
A lot. On May 30th, 1977, Daily News columnist Jimmy Breslin received a handwritten letter from someone claiming to be the son of Sam. The writer of the letter name-checks one of the first victims, Donna Loria, warning Breslin not to forget her, and he cannot let the people forget her either, writing, "She was a very, very sweet girl, but Sam's a thirsty lad, and he won't let me stop killing until he gets his fill of blood." The letter was signed Son of Sam. What the fuck?
Very scary.
The Daily News presented the letter to the police and 10 days later published a redacted version in what would become one of the paper's biggest selling issues ever, with more than 1 million copies sold. Well, no shit. You're publishing a serial killer's letter in the newspaper. Of course, I would have bought several copies.
Yep.
On June 26, 1977, the son of Sam struck again. After leaving a disco in Bayside, Queens, 17-year-old Judy Palacido and 20-year-old Sal Lupo were shot while sitting in Sal's parked car. Both survived their injuries, with Sal reportedly telling the police that he and Judy had been discussing the Son of Sam killer only minutes before the attack.
Yikes.
That would fucking scare the shit out of me.
Yeah.
On July 31st, 1977, just 2 days after the anniversary of Berkowitz's first killing, he shot 20-year-old Robert Volanetti and 19-year-old Stacy Moskowitz in Brooklyn as they were sitting in Robert's car on their first date. Stacy was fatally wounded, dying 18 hours later in the hospital. Robert lost his left eye and nearly all the vision in his right eye. Not only was this the first attack to happen in the borough of Brooklyn, but was also the first with a female victim having blonde hair.
Uh-oh.
Because all you girls started dyeing your hair blonde.
He's like, you'll do.
Yep. Now, as luck would have it, just a few days later, there was a major break in the case when an eyewitness came forward claiming that she had seen a man with what looked like a gun minutes before the shots were fired in the deadly Brooklyn shooting. The eyewitness's information led to the first police sketch of Berkowitz, but more importantly, she reported that other police officers had been writing parking tickets in the same area that night.
Uh-oh.
A search revealed one of the ticketed cars that night belonged to 24-year-old David Berkowitz, who was already being investigated over complaints of harassment of a neighbor.
It's all coming together.
Yep. Now, if you remember, the Yonkers Police Department had opened an investigation when Berkowitz's neighbor Sam Carr's Labrador Retriever was shot, with Berkowitz being the main suspect. The Omega Force detectives finally put two and two together.
Yeah.
It's about damn time.
I know.
David Berkowitz's reigning terror over New York City streets and boroughs finally came to an end 11 days after his latest murder. On August 10, 1977, Berkowitz was arrested in front of his Yonkers, New York apartment building. Police had investigated Berkowitz's car prior to his arrest and discovered a rifle in the back seat, as well as maps of the crime scenes and ammunition. That scared the shit out of me.
So, but I mean, shit, wow. This is where I want to stop for a minute and talk about the competency thing. Okay, so when you talk about doing things and being incompetent, you very, very rarely have any kind of premeditation in it, right? You won't find these kind of things that just fell in the back seat, right? When somebody's incompetent and they commit a crime, it's because they lose their mind and it's a impulsive, just boom, it happens. And they're doing it because they have no right mind. There's no pre-planning. They just go and do it and come back. Like there's no pre, this guy, he had pre-planning. He knew what he was doing. He had certain victims he looked for. So yes, he was totally competent at the time.
I would agree.
While what drove him to do the killings, I get, you know, demons telling you to do it, but then going and doing it and planning it and looking into it, there's a level of competency there that, you know, somebody who is incompetent wouldn't know that they wouldn't know the right from wrong. They wouldn't follow up with letters. They wouldn't, you know, it would just be a thing of done and over with and move on for me. At least that's how I look at it.
I would agree with that.
In my kind of opinion, it's the fact that he had planning in it. He had things that helped him get there. You know, he had certain victim types that he was using. Everything he did, ladies, you say he was competent at some level.
He knew
he was doing.
Yeah, I would agree.
I mean, it sucks that a demon told you to do it, but you still were able to go carry out the crime in a competent manner.
Yes, I would agree. Now, police would wait until Berkowitz left his apartment building and he was arrested as he sat behind the wheel of his car.
So fitting, right? So fitting.
I don't know if that's where I would have arrested him, having ammunition and a rifle in it. Like, I feel like I would have tried to arrest him before that.
Yeah. Well, they're probably like, oh, shit, we better get him before he goes and fucking kill somebody else.
A smiling Berkowitz reportedly said to the arresting officer, well, you got me.
Yeah. And this is another level of competency, right?
Yeah.
This is it right here. Oh, you got me. So you're not crazy. Like, you're not incompetent. Like, you know what's going on around you and your surroundings when you're committing these kind of crimes.
I would agree with that. Berkowitz gleefully admitted to being the son of Sam, and he explained he was on his way to commit another murder.
There you go. That's why the cops were like, shit, we better get him.
On his person, police would find a semi-automatic rifle, and next to him in a bag was the .44 caliber Bulldog revolver. I mean, you know, he might want to change that up a little bit, but...
Mistake. I would love to ask him, why did you carry this semi-automatic rifle?
What was that for? You've never used it before. Why did you carry that with you?
I would love to have that question answered.
Maybe you can, Corey.
Maybe I can.
Write to him. He likes letters.
He does. My penmanship is terrible, though. I'm going to be fucked.
I'll write
the computer.
I'll write it for you.
I have to type it on the computer. Oh, you can write it for me.
I got nice teacher handwriting.
And then he'll be like, I want to talk to the person who wrote this letter. Not the one that authored it, but the one that wrote it.
No, thank you.
I like your handwriting.
Nope. The following day, Berkowitz would confess to the shootings, claiming that he had been commanded to kill by his neighbor, Sam Carr, who sent messages to Berkowitz through his Labrador retriever named Harvey. So, shit just gets real crazy.
Here's my question, though, okay? So did Harvey tell you exactly how to kill? Or was that your part? He just told you to kill and you had to figure out how to do it. See, that's the competency level that we're looking at here, right? If somebody incompetent, the dog told me to do it, so I just went and I killed him right then and there because the dog told me to do it. I grabbed whatever manner or means I had to kill and I killed. Incompetent, totally. Right. Well, and then when people get you, I don't know what you're talking. I don't know what to tell you. I don't know. I don't know. They seriously don't know because they're incompetent at the time of their. This guy, you got me. I had it all planned out how I was going
to
do it.
There's about a level to go commit another murder.
About to go do it now. There's another level of competency. Now, I'm not saying he wasn't mentally ill, but he was competent when he committed these murders.
I would agree with that. Sam Carr's Labrador, Harvey, was said to be possessed by a 6,000-year-old demon. It's a little crazy.
I know. I wonder what he read or what he saw for it to be a 6,000-year-old demon.
Ghostbusters?
Well, not back in the 70s.
Oh, I guess that was the 80s, huh?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I have to go back and research that and see, like, what movies was going on at that time that he would come up with a 6,000-year-old demon.
Pretty interesting, huh?
I wonder if the dogs ever checked out Sam and the dog. Just saying.
There's nothing wrong with that dog.
Or Sam. He's just an old man that didn't like nobody messing with his house or his yard.
That's exactly what it was.
That's why he said 6,000-year-old demon, because he was old. When he looked at his neighbor, all he saw was the oldness in him.
The oldness.
Mm-hmm.
Berkowitz stated to detectives, he told me to kill. Sam is the devil. He also made statements that he had been part of a violent, satanic cult that orchestrated the murders along with fellow cult members John and Michael Carr, the real sons of Sam Carr, though no hard evidence was ever uncovered to support the claim.
Wow. I mean...
That's all sorts of crazy.
I mean, it's so crazy, it's almost truthful.
It is.
And it's his... Well, we have to understand it's his reality. right? It is his reality of what he's telling you. It's his reality. It doesn't have to be our reality, but it is his reality.
Not only did Berkowitz confess to the shootings, but he also claimed to be responsible for the 1,500 fires set around the city. His tales of demons, murder, and terror led to an even more intense media coverage of the case and further flamed the satanic panic of the 1970s. And that's a real fucking thing.
It is a very real fucking thing.
And he also had his Manson.
Manson.
He also fueled that big time.
Yep. And you had Bundy.
And Bundy. Yep. Berkowitz was only too delighted to be in the spotlight and, in fact, proceeded to sell his exclusive story rights to a publishing house. That prompted New York State to adopt the first in a nationwide series of Son of Sam laws that take proceeds a criminal earns from selling their story and gives them to the victim's compensation fund. Well, that's pretty good that they can't make money off that.
I don't think
they should be able to. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I like it, though.
I like it. Due to his outrageous claims, Berkowitz underwent numerous psychological evaluations but was declared competent to stand trial. However, on May 8, 1978, he withdrew his insanity defense and pleaded guilty to the 6 murders. Berkowitz's sentencing hearing was dramatic as he tried to jump out of a window on the 7th floor courtroom upon hearing the judge's decision giving him 6 25-year life sentences, the maximum penalty allowed at the time. I would have loved to have been in that courtroom that day and trying to jump out of the fucking window.
That's why he's competent right there, folks.
Yeah, because he knew exactly what was going on. Mm-hmm. His butthole is about to get played with.
Oh, yeah. His butthole puckered.
In 1979, directly after his incarceration at Attica Correctional Facility, Berkowitz was attacked by an inmate and slashed across the neck. He later moved to the Sullivan Correctional Facility in Fallsburg, New York. I'm telling you. I mean, I know that criminals are criminals, but they really sometimes have this like code that they don't.
Oh, yeah, they do. They have a very certain code they follow.
In 1996, Yonkers police reopened Berkowitz's case to investigate some of his claims of being part of a satanic cult that supposedly took part in the shooting. But since there's been no significant findings, the investigation has been suspended but remains unclosed. Yeah, because it's not true.
Yeah, it's not true. But what do you do?
In an interview with CBS in 2013, Berkowitz attempted to correct misperceptions about him. In the interview, he claimed that he was not ordered to kill by his neighbor's dog, nor was he part of a demonic cult. He claimed instead that he had felt like a soldier on a mission. He said he believed Satan would release him from his emotional pain and loneliness if he killed. He also said he had not taken any medication and was not mentally ill. Buddy, you're not helping yourself look any more sane.
Nope.
In a 2017 television interview with CBS News, Berkowitz stated, "I see that people will never understand where I come from. No matter how much I try to explain it, they wouldn't understand what it was like to walk in darkness."
Nope. I don't understand that. I don't. Mm-hmm. I agree with him. I don't understand.
Yep. I concur. When asked whether he was the sole shooter in each incident, Berkowitz said he took responsibility for all shootings. When asked if anyone else was involved, he said, "Let's put it this way. There were demons." You're still crazy.
Yeah. Still got demon issues.
So far, David Berkowitz has been denied parole and is currently held at the Shawangunk Correctional Facility in upstate New York, where he has become an evangelical Christian, preferring now to go by the name of Son of Hope.
Son of God. Oh, Jesus.
But many still wonder if Berkowitz acted alone. According to Jen Rothstein, a retired New York detective who was working on the Vice Squad during the Son of Sam killings and investigated suspicions of a satanic cult being behind much of the violent criminal activity during the 1970s, believes that Berkowitz didn't do all the killings. Rothstein told A&E Real Crime, "Once they locked up Berkowitz and blamed him for everything, they said it was done. But Berkowitz was just the guy who took the rap. It was a much bigger thing." Mm-hmm. I don't know if I believe that.
Mm.
I'm sorry. Investigative reporter Maury Terry also believed that Berkowitz did not act alone. In his book, The Ultimate Evil, Terry attempted to connect Berkowitz's crimes to other occult-linked killings in the United States, while also trying to prove that Berkowitz's murders required accomplices, namely Berkowitz's neighbors, John and Michael Carr, the Sons of Sam Carr. Terry grew increasingly convinced the three were not only accomplices, but members of a larger satanic cult known as the Children, with murky ties to Charles Manson.
Mm.
Terry's suspicions were only heightened when both Sam Carr's sons met untimely end shortly after Berkowitz's arrest. John Carr died by a reported suicide as police knocked on his door in North Dakota in 1978, and Michael Carr in a car accident the following year. Do you think there's any truth to this? Or you think this is a stretch?
I think this is a stretch.
I do too.
I think Berkowitz acted alone, and I think these guys got tangled up into it because of, you know, whether Michael Carr was doing something messed up when the police knocked on his door and that's why they were knocking on his door and that's why he committed suicide. I don't think it correlated to this.
I don't either.
But I don't think it made their life any easier being tied to a serial killer.
I would agree with that. According to Men's Health magazine, Terry was ultimately unable to convince police investigators to reopen the case, and though he managed to gain access to Berkowitz for a televised interview, an interview in which Berkowitz appeared to concede he was not the sole trigger man for the murders, many discredited Terry's investigations, his interview techniques, and the foundations for many of his claims.
Yeah, you have to be really careful when you interview people who have mental illnesses like this, because they will actually feed you what you want to hear. And so you can really, if your interview techniques are not on point, you could really go down a rabbit hole with them.
I would agree. All right, mistakes?
I mean, you know.
Same gun?
Yeah. Well, I mean, not so much the same gun. I mean, you're going to say that a lot. It does help. I'm not going to lie. Definitely leaving his victims alive. You know, that was.
Leaving witnesses.
Leaving witnesses. I've always said that. That's a big, you know, mistake on his part. And on the other part, you know, I think the cops did the best they did with what they had.
True. And it was the 70s.
Yeah, at the time, they did the best they did with what they had. And unfortunately, they had to rely heavily on, you know, eyewitnesses. But then, hey, they did a great job with getting the information about the traffic tickets and then going forth and finding him and possibly stopping more killings, obviously. So
I would agree with that.
Definitely. This was very interesting.
He's definitely an interesting guy, isn't he?
Yes, he's very interesting. He's a really, really, really in-depth serial killer for me, or I call massive killer, because I don't think he was necessarily... I know he fits the profile for serial killing, absolutely, 100%, but he just, to me, he just wanted to kill as many people as he could to get the attention.
I really do. I agree with that, too.
Well, this was a fun one, Court.
It was a fun one.
All right, y'all. As always, stay stranger than usual.
We'll be back next week with another cocktail and a new tale of sinister minds, their menacing crimes, and mistakes they left behind. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to subscribe and download us on Spotify, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite show.
Want the recipe to try Corey's sinister cocktail from today's episode? Or have any constructive feedback or true crime stories you would like to hear us cover? Or even sinister cocktail recipes for us to try? Email us at sinistercrimesandcocktails@gmail.com. Visit our website, www.sinistercrimesandcocktailspodcast.com, Facebook page, Sinister Crimes and Cocktails, and our Instagram page, Sinister Crimes and Cocktails.
Love what you heard and want to help support our show or donate to our Sinister Cocktail Fund? You can donate to our Cash App at @SinisterCrimes, all one word, and we will give you a shout out on our next episode and which fund you donate to. Thank you.